So today, something totally different. No equations. Those don't. I didn't do those.
You look right now.
And there's a lot of mistakes here, so it's not mine. So it's something totally different, something we started getting interested in about 2013 already. So it's got this. Sounds recent, but it's not so recent. I think it has great potential, and I'll see if I can convince you of that. That will be my task. So here on the first slide, I have the most important thing. These are really the people who did all the work. Brian Martin is my graduate student. Guillermo Romero is a colleague. He's from Lima, Peru, and he was crying when they lost. Well, anyway. And Beth has been my tech for a long time, and she's my right hand. And Ansuman Chattopadhyay, bioinformatics drug, who teaches that to all the medical students at UPMC. And he has been a wonderful resource for us in order to move on with some of the stuff I'll show you later. So my outline is, I'm just going to tell you something about relaxin. How many of you heard of relaxin before?
I mean relaxin.
Yeah. We know that. It's a name that unfortunately is sticking, and that's the name of this hormone. So I'll give you some background about it, and then I'll show you some of our data of relaxin on aged rats, and how you have major effects by this hormone on the heart, extracellular matrix remodeling, electrical remodeling. And now our latest new stuff is, how does it do all these things? And we are trying to nail down the mechanism and the signaling pathways that relaxin drives to produce so many changes in the heart, as well as other organs. So it's a hormone that acts on virtually all the organs in our body, and I'll tell you more.
How is it produced?
That's debatable. That's a question I'll raise, but I won't answer. And then some RNA-seq data that we published recently on the actions, the genomic actions of this hormone. So first let me tell you a little bit about relaxin. It was discovered way back in 1926. Well, in the grand scheme of things, that's not that old. But what was interesting is that it was a bit accidental. They took serum from a pregnant animal, and when you drizzle it on the ligament of any other animal, it tends to relax. And hence, it caught, this name caught. There is something in the serum that is doing something that we don't know about, and only pregnant mammals, as it turns out, it's more than mammals, even fish have it, have this component in it, and they never identified it. And then it received its name, of course. They got cruder extracts, and the paper in 1930 at least got the information that it was probably at high concentrations in the corpora lutea of females. And crude preparations, again, it's important for pregnancy, but they don't know what it is.
But what about humans? Is there any known for humans?
Oh yeah, plenty is known. I'm getting to that part. That's the best part.
Parallels oxytocin almost?
No, it's very different from oxytocin. So, after a very long hiatus from 1930, 1977, 1980s, they finally got an amino acid sequence, and you can now make a recombinant form of this peptide. And the recombinant form of the peptide now opened up the field. So most of what we know is really from 1982, where some significant progress was made. So it was cloned from rats, from other species after that, and now you could make it in sufficient quantities so you could start studying. And when it was discovered, one of the first things that they realize is that these GPCR receptors that had unknown ligands or activators where they finally found their match. It's relaxin that activates and interacts with these receptors. So relaxin deorphanized a number of receptors that are in mammalians. And so it's now known to be an insulin-like hormone, so it has an A band and a B band, and it has three disulfides, two bridge the A and B peptides, and then there's an intrapeptide disulfide. So it's a 53 amino acids, and it's very much like insulin, but it's not insulin. And in the humans, we have H1 and H2 relaxins, which is relaxin 1, I'm sorry, H1 and H2, because RLN1 and RLN2 are the actual genes that make the peptide. And they have been characterized in 1984. And RLN2, the main form of relaxin, which is what I'm going to be talking to you about, is primarily expressed in the corpus luteum of nearly all the species that has been looked at. And this is the one that's referred to as relaxin. Now, relaxin 1 and 2 are throughout the body of man. And there's another form called relaxin 3, which is primarily found in the brain. And relaxin 3 has a separate receptor. Relaxin 2 interacts with a receptor called RXFP1. And we'll show you more on that. The corpus luteum is an organ in, it's a reproductive organ in women. You don't have one. I don't have one either, don't feel bad. But mice have two relaxins, RLX2 is their RLX1, and they have one in the brain. So in some rodents, there's only two, but in the rat, there's all three. And so many mammals basically express all three. So in some cases, veterinarians, as it turns out, know a lot more about relaxin than doctors. Why? Because when they treat mammals, like the large cats and bears and so on, and they want to find out if they're pregnant or not, I mean, they could do an echocardiogram, but they may not like it too much, and they may kill the tech who's doing it. And it's not a good idea to anesthetize a pregnant animal. It could cause irreparable harm. And so the urine doesn't always work as a test for pregnancy, and so they actually measure relaxin levels in the urine. So in man, we cannot measure relaxin in our bodies. The only time we can measure relaxin is during gestation. During gestation, relaxin levels rise in the bloodstream in women, and it reaches a peak at the 6 months to 7 months level. It stays leveled off, and it's absolutely essential for parturition because it relaxes the birth canal and allows the baby to come out. And after birth, the levels of relaxin plummet again within 24 hours, and again, they're not measurable. So does that mean it doesn't do anything? Well, men have the receptors for relaxin. Women have receptors for relaxin in nearly every organ in the body. So it's not unique to the birth canal. The uterus is one of the organs that's most affected and known to be important in pregnancy because as the embryo grows, you get a huge stretching of the musculature, and that would normally make that very fibrotic. But if relaxin is present in the right quantities, it remains completely compliant. So it stretches, it relaxes, and the embryo is not under any pressure. The formation of the placenta has also been implicated as being modulated by relaxin. And preeclampsia is now, there are some places where they treat women with preeclampsia with relaxin. The placenta is a large vascular cable made up of spiral arteries. And in the absence of relaxin in some women where relaxin levels are too low, the cable doesn't develop properly and huge pressures develop, and the pregnant woman has very high levels of pressure, and it's very perilous and lethal in some cases. So what about men? One way to study it is to take a mouse and knock out the RLX. And when you knock out RLX, the mouse develops fibrosis everywhere in his body at a young age. And if you give him relaxin back, you salvage it. So male and female become fibrotic if you eliminate relaxin. So it's one of the most potent anti-fibrotic, and nearly every paper and study where they looked at fibrosis in the liver, the lung, the kidney, the heart, from me, and so on, have shown a very potent anti-fibrotic effect. So it's really changing the genomics of these organs in some very fundamental ways, and this is what we're trying to figure out what it's doing. And so this is a schematic of relaxin. Here's your A band and V band, and this is RXFP1, its receptor. It has an isoleucine rich zone.
A band and B band, can you comment, are they connected?
Yeah, they're connected with disulfide bonds, like insulin. So to make this peptide, right?
Before you go further, one more question.
This is A, yeah?
Does relaxin interact with insulin receptors, or it doesn't?
It has a very high affinity binding. It's in the sub-nanomolar range, and it's very selective. Okay. RXFP2 is very similar to this, but the affinity of relaxin to RXFP2 is much lower. And so most effects that we're seeing, we are confident that we're seeing interaction between this peptide and this receptor. And so there's a binding site, a high affinity binding site here, a low affinity binding site in this receptor, and this bugger here is very complicated. Let me show you some of the things that it does. So it's a GPCR, so it interacts with G-alpha I3, G-alpha 3, GAOB, and so these essentially activate adenyl cyclase. Adenyl cyclase results in cyclo-KMP elevation, PK activation, Krebs activation. So this is one of the most dominant pathways that has been studied a lot. It may interact with the receptor tyrosine kinase, which activates PI3K, and this has an effect on nitric oxide activity. And it appears that there's also, through ERK modifications, an increase in iNOS, which increases NO. So one of the a number of studies in different cell types, this is not cardiac necessarily, although some of the work has been done in cardiac, is an elevation in nitric oxide, which signals a number of other features of this peptide. This particular effect through Krebs can have a lot of genomic effects through Krebs phosphorylation. There is some data on phosphodiesterase and another, maybe two papers, that discuss the effects of H2 relaxin on glucocorticoid receptors. And the glucocorticoid receptors have binding elements on promoter regions of genes and also can have downstream effects. So if this is a complicated set of possible mechanisms, it's because it is, and it's also because it's been difficult to measure all of these in the same cell type. So a lot of the studies that resulted in this overall pathway, signaling pathway, comes from multiplicity of cell types. So more recently, it's been very involved in the cardiovascular system. What is relaxin doing in the cardiovascular system? So that includes the heart and the vessels and so on. So this, I already told you, is the effect of nitric oxide and on multi-organ fibrosis. And it also has an effect on arterial compliance. And this is work that was done by Kirk Conrad and Sanjeev Shroff. And they were in Pittsburgh at the time when they did this work. And they essentially showed that relaxin reduced systemic arterial compliance. So this is one of the many phenomena that occurs in pregnant women. And if you add the concentrations that are somewhat equivalent to what you see in pregnancy, they have the same effect. So Novartis, a few years back, yeah.
Did relaxing reverse fibrosis, or did it prevent a formation of fibrosis in that muscle?
So if you knock it out, fibrosis develops. If you give them relaxin back, you reverse it.
At what age do
you? This was done in a young, relatively young adults, so the mouse were probably in the four months old.
Reversing, like the fibrotic tissue gets replaced with.
What?
Depleted. The fibrotic tissue disappears somehow.
It's not somehow. We have an explanation.
Okay.
I will show you cardiac data.
Okay.
Right? Because, yeah, that's the point. That's why we're here. Precisely for that. Right. So, this is an interesting topic. What happened with Novartis? Novartis decided to see if it had an impact on hemodynamics in heart failure. Here's the idea. When they found that it increases arterial compliance, and you have a patient that comes in with decompensated acute heart failure, they have great difficulties breathing, they have dyspnea, and the current treatment is, of course, to treat them with diuretics, to get the fluids out, and you hospitalize them when you do that. And this is a very one of the costly things that happens in our public health system, to take care of patients with have dyspnea and run to the hospital. So in this, they saw an opportunity to test relaxin as a therapy to improve dyspnea, to make them feel better faster. So they received the standard of care plus relaxin or a placebo. And when they actually did this, they said, oh yes, yes, the patients felt better in the SIR-RELAX clinical trials. And part of the FDA requirement was that they follow the patients for 6 months to make sure it didn't have untoward pharmacological effects and made them sick. They gave them, by the way, the human relaxin form. So it's a recombinant human relaxin that they invested on a company called Corthera that had this production with good manufacturing process rules. And they bought this company for $600 million. And then Novartis started these clinical trials in a number of avenues. But this is the famous one. When they followed these patients for 6 months, they said, something happened. And what happened is that there were fewer deaths by 37%. And so it changed mortality in such a way that FDA say this is a breakthrough therapy, go. In other words, don't wait, go for the next phase. Push the therapy. And so they did. They went through another clinical trial, and they kept dyspnea as the endpoint, and they improved dyspnea. Well, dyspnea is very subjective. The patient, do you feel better? Yeah, I feel better. But the guy who received the diuretics also feels much better. So it was a very soft thing. And so they came up and they had a 38% decrease in mortality. And they went back to the FDA, we want approval, and they said, no, the endpoint is mortality, not dyspnea. And the European community, same thing, they didn't approve it. So they went for a third trial. And this time they didn't see any difference. So what happened? This is the trial that is throwing everybody off kilter, because they give the drug for 2 days in IV, and then they send the patient home, and they want to see an effect 6 months later. And so there was, why do they do that? Why 2 days? Why not 3 days? And how do you know what is the right time and the right concentration? They had a few tests with concentration, but they were minimalistic, not very extensive. But the 2 day, it has everything to do with Medicare, because they have certain rules that if you have heart failure, you're hospitalized, you get 2 days in the hospital. And if you don't come back within so many months, then if you do come back to the hospital, it's considered another visit independent of the first one, so you can get paid again. But if you come back and you're re-hospitalized within 6 months, they say, well, you didn't treat him properly, that's why he's back in the hospital. So they have rules for payments of physicians that are dependent on this period. And typically, it also...
Rules are set by the hospital, right?
Sorry?
Rules are set by the hospital.
No. No, if they get paid, they would be happy to keep them.
Okay. Yeah. So, but that two-day administration was the same as the initial deployment study, correct?
Yeah.
The 37% reduction, was that phase two trial, or...?
Yeah, there were two trials, and they worked both times.
Phase two?
Yeah.
But how was the protocol for the third trial? How was it different?
They never published that, but I was at this meeting, and one of the Ter Link, who was one of the physicians involved, it's just what happened is that those who weren't treated did much better. So there was no signal. In other words, the treatment when you take a patient, they didn't care if it was male or female. They didn't care what the history of heart failure was. Some had lived with heart failure for decades and then had an attack with dyspnea and went to the hospital. Some were newly discovered heart failure patients. So there was a huge range of people. And so some people had the private physician, they had good treatment and follow-up by their own private doctors, and some had very poor treatment in their past history. And so it seems as if the mortality of the average patient with heart failure was just doing better. They didn't die in 6 months because the mortality level was measured still at 6 months. And the last, from what I gathered, why that trial failed is that standard of care had improved, if you will, from the earlier trials.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that the preliminary study included the sicker population, whereas the UKC trial included healthier people in heart failure.
They tried to keep the same, but it didn't turn out that way. They had also, one difference is that they wanted to look at patients with higher BNP levels, brain natriuretic factor, which is a marker of hemodynamic injury in these patients. And so they thought they were going to get a sicker population, but they didn't. Okay? I'll have a little bit more to say about that. But so, relaxin and aging. Aging is associated with a lot of cardiac fibrosis, so it stood to reason to test that, to see if an aged animal with chronic fibrosis over the years of development, that this atrial fibrillation is also another factor that you see that is age-related, and there are other electrical abnormalities that occur with age. The sodium current decreases, the NAV1.5 peptide. There may be, I will show you that. People didn't know that before, but changes in these in cellular hypertrophy, in gap junction, and so on. And so a geriatric model of atrial fibrillation can relax and do something. And what are the effects of relax on the structural and electrical properties of the aged rat? So we use the rat, the F344 rat, which is an animal that was developed really by the National Institute of Aging, primarily because aging is linear in that animal. In many other rat strains, you might see all this, the adulthood, no signs of aging, and then abruptly you have a kick where a lot of the organ failures and damage occurs. The F344 Fischer rat, however, is known for this linearity, and there's a ton of research on this model for that reason. It's also because a 2-year-old rat is equivalent to a 90-year-old person, and that's a manageable age. Because you see sometimes papers, we're going to study old rabbits, and they study a 6 or an 8-year-old rabbit. But that's not an old rabbit. You have to wait till he's 16 or 18 years old in order to get an old rabbit. The mice have a lot of the features, but they don't have this linear aging. And for cardiac issues, it's very hard to measure atrial fibrillation in a mouse. So they already go at 680 beats a minute. And to see atrial fibrillation, you're hard-pressed. And most of the studies where they look at atrial fibrillation, it's transient, it's brief, and it's not sustained enough so that you feel secure that you have changed atrial fibrillation to any extent in the mouse. So here is a figure where you show changes in fibrosis with age in this rat, and you can see that at 20 months old, there's a significant increase in fibrosis. And so this has been known now for a while.
Can you comment on the lower row? This is EM.
Sorry, you want the other one?
What does this yellow arrows show?
So you have here are myocytes, and the fibrosis is essentially perivascular in nature, and that's what the arrows are pointing to. So you see large zones, and you see how large is this is the interstitial spaces between myocytes here and myocytes here, and you can see how these become more and more pronounced, and the reporter here is collagen, which is one of the major components of the extracellular matrix. There's some laminin and fibrinogen, but people tend to measure collagen as the main marker of fibrosis. So, and that's what we're pointing you to look at that. Another early report, in fact, this from Pan Cheng Chang and Jim Weiss at UCLA. And so here's a young animal. This is the young rat, right atrial signal, left atrial, and left ventricular. So here they stimulate with burst pacing, and then you stop. It goes right back into sinus rhythm, and this is the right atrium. The pulses are applied on the right atrium. That's why you see them here, and you see the electrical pulses here. And the left, of course, is also responding, but it breaks. The moment you stop the burst pacing, the heart goes right back into sinus rhythm. Now, in an old rat, you see different effects. Here you have an atrial tachycardia after the burst, and it doesn't stay on the ventricle. This is atrial in nature. And another example is you apply the burst and you have an atrial fibrillation. And so this is the AF signal, and you see that because you've paced on the right has an atrial fibrillation, and it looks like the left is more on a tachycardia scheme rather than a full AF. And this is the left ventricle.
What is the way it's the globe?
Sorry?
How is it the globe develops between right atrium and left atrium?
So you have like
the right atrium, left atrium.
Yeah, his question is that the in an old in a pallid sea, you have two different tachycardia, and on the right side's fib, and the left side it's a tachycardia. So that doesn't usually happen. My speculation was that it's so fibrotic that they have some.
Yeah, they do have a lot of fibrosis. Yes. Why are they?
This is a different. Are those recording simultaneous or they are not?
These are recorded simultaneously, and these are recorded simultaneously. See.
So here we have like array.
Yeah. Look, you see there's a delay. These are different electrodes, and they're located in different regions of the two chambers.
So this it just happened to be the electrode in
it depends where it's located,
so
yeah.
So it was located in the area that wouldn't get one-to-one or something. So
I think it's very close to one-to-one. This is.
No, I'm talking about.
He had to complain to Jim to see if it's one-to-one.
I'm talking about the fib.
This one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is totally different. This one is under fibrillation, and this one is not. It's only in tachycardia.
So one part of the atrium is fibrillating the other.
Sure, the right doesn't know what the left is doing. That's the motto here. Yeah, that's correct. But the burst was applied on the right side.
And ventricular rate is very slow.
I'm sorry?
Ventricular rate, you have huge forces, nothing gets into the ventricle.
Right. Yeah, it's a supraventricular arrhythmia. And nothing was done to the rat, it's just old. That's the main message. And the young doesn't do that. The young is protected.
And how come for the old one there is nothing in the LV, I mean the AV node doesn't fire?
Yeah, but much more slowly.
Oh, so it's on a longer time.
Yeah. It would, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's 300 milliseconds.
Will this arrhythmia terminate and then you use it and then it will last forever?
So, I'm trying to remember if the paper tracked that. It was really long-lived. It's quite sustained. Because in our experiments, it was quite sustained. You have to add KCL to resynchronize it and stop it. So we didn't see it stop spontaneously. So which also is an important thing for us because it raises the confidence that we do have arrhythmias or you don't have arrhythmia. If the arrhythmia stops spontaneously, and so now you have to worry about what is the duration of the AF in treatment or no treatment. So it becomes more difficult to get the statistics to be significant and believable. But a sustained AF is actually very helpful for that.
But do you have control without this burst pacing, what this old rat will do if you don't?
Nothing happens if it's no burst pacing, no arrhythmia. This is not my data. I will show you that with our rats. Okay, so this is our protocol. They get the vehicle, or he's kind of cute, eh? That's what we're dealing with, right? This is the point, and hopefully that you'll be convinced that we can do something with that. Okay, so they get a vehicle control, which is sodium acetate, which is all you need to dissolve the peptide, the relaxin peptide. And we put on, they all get a mini pump, a Nalzet, an osmotic mini pump that releases the peptide in a linear fashion. And these are well-characterized mini pumps. We just buy them. We don't make them. And the rats are getting 0.4 milligrams per kilo per day. And we do this for 2 weeks.
One question about this vehicle you said.
Sodium acetate.
Why is that? It's not water soluble, this peptide?
Well, sodium acetate is just a little acid to make sure it doesn't change in its conformation.
So the
it probably works in just distilled water, but we are afraid that it might either precipitate in the pump itself before it's released. It keeps it more soluble for the two-week period. And you need to make sure that happens so that you have a linear release of relaxin in the bloodstream of the animal. So the relaxin is actually subcutaneous. It diffuses into the vasculature, and then we measure relaxin levels using an ELISA assay to find out what the relaxin is in the bloodstream.
It's rat relaxin.
No, we're using human relaxin. Okay. The affinities aren't very different. So people have actually worried that if you use a human relaxant on a rat, that you might get an immune response. And then it wouldn't work. It would essentially cause in fact, it would make the rat quite sick. And we haven't seen that problem. And it may be that they're very similar between the human and the rat, and it's only 2 weeks. It's not. If you waited even longer, maybe you'd get an immune response from that. But the rats never seem to have a stimulation of white blood cells or a rash where this is released. So after that, we then we did this with aged and young, right? So we have aged and young with and without relaxant. And then the hearts were isolated, so we did optical mapping. This is our optical mapping setup, so you can measure voltage and calcium. And you isolate the tissue for RT-PCR, histology, and RNA analysis. So this is our protocol. This is where, instead of burst spacing, you apply S1, S1 beats, and then you apply premature pulse. 250 milliseconds is sort of the natural sinus rhythm of these rats when you put them on Langendorf. It's a little slower than the intact animal. It would be it'll be shorter cycle length in the intact animal. And then we apply an S2 pulse every 20 milliseconds from 200 to 100, and then we drop that to 5 milliseconds until you have either the refractory period, loss of capture, or you have an atrial fibrillation is initiated. So this is basically what happens when you apply an S1, S2 of short duration, and then you get a burst, but it's transient, and then it goes back into sinus rhythm by itself. But if you make the S1, S2 even shorter, then you get into a sustained AF, and it doesn't stop.
So just the burst of S1?
No, we didn't do burst. We just S1, S2.
Where's
S2? So the S2 came here at around 50 millisecond S1, S2. And then you get a transient one. Then you reduce it further, and then it did that. So here is an aged rat treated with a relaxant. And there's the S2. And goes right into sinus rhythm. Another S2 fails to capture, right into sinus rhythm. No AF. And so that was stopped on its track. Control pulse. Sorry?
The signal was voltage or calcium?
Voltage. Yeah. We're looking here at a centimeter and a half, 100 by 100 pixels. And then the arrhythmia starts. Yeah, LARA and the ventricles, you're seeing all of them. Okay, so this is the statistics. If you have a controlled animal with no relaxant, I think they all had sustained atrial fibrillation except for one. We just had one aged animal that didn't have AF. And after you treat them with relaxin, three of them had some brief 10-second AF. Most of them didn't have any AF after relaxin treatment.
You're talking here about inducibility.
Yeah, because I applied S1, S2 protocol.
But did they have spontaneous arrhythmias?
So we didn't want to add that to be an additional list. Those who had relaxin, none of them had spontaneous AF. The aged ones, about 30% have spontaneous AF. And we only had one that didn't have AF. He was he lived right, this old rat. Not spontaneous or induced. So what happened? One of the we did the restitution analysis of conduction velocity. But look at this graph here, where we looked at conduction velocity in the left atrium as a function of cycle length. So when you pace at 200, well, this is the natural rate for them, 250 milliseconds, and you look at the age drag, notice that only three were stable at that rate. And then when you go faster, conduction velocity goes down. And if you go even faster, conduction velocity goes down even more. After relaxing therapy, conduction velocity is considerably higher. It's close to 0.9. And it doesn't sink. At this rate here, none of the old rats without relaxing therapy could go that fast. They wouldn't capture. Yet, after relaxing therapy, all of the animals were able to be paced and maintain a conduction velocity at nearly all these velocities.
The moment the experiments were done, how long has relaxin been presented?
Maybe 2 weeks. It's in the protocol, right? Okay. Not 2 days like Novartis. Yeah?
This conduction velocity is measured globally along all the ventricle?
I'm sorry. I did not explain how I measure that. So we have an array, a CMOS array, and it has all the pixels that are detecting action potentials, okay? So I take one pixel, and I measure the time delay between its eight nearest neighbors. There's four neighbors that are exactly adjacent, and then there's the neighbors that are on the diagonal. And so the distances are different, so you correct that by the square root of 2 for the unitary dimension. And then you measure the time delay when the upstroke fires. And so you measure a local vector at each pixel. So the local vector at each pixel depends only on its nearest neighbors. It doesn't know what anything happened further away.
It's a local vector.
Right. And then you add them up and you get a resultant vector, which is the sum of the local vectors. So the resultant, you can measure it in any orientation or angle you want. So here we measure the maximum, the maximum resultant from the sum of the local vectors.
And I suppose that the heterogeneity is further increased in the second case.
Yeah, because there is fibrosis, and I will show that, yeah. Sorry, Arkady.
So you're measuring local velocity. And then
no, this is the maximum resultant vector, which is the one along the atrium doesn't have a clear cut alignment of fibers like you have in the ventricle, where you can measure a longitudinal and a transverse, right? And so in these animals, you just measure all the local vectors, sum them up, and you get a maximum magnitude and a certain direction.
So, for example, I understand that you have this activation time. You have a kind of three, for each point x, y, activation time is a function.
I don't use activation time. Throw away activation time. That's not what I'm doing.
But then we can take a gradient of this function.
No, that's not correct. That's not accurate.
We're normal to that gradient.
You use activation time. Let me show you what I use. So let's say this is a pixel on the camera.
Yes.
And it has adjacent pixels.
You see, the gradient is not accurate because of the noise.
I take gradient in voltage or something.
So here, I measure a very sharp action potential. Okay?
Yes.
If I take the first derivative of this action potential, I obtain a unique time point. This is when this pixel fired electrically.
So
this is my T. And I get a time point T. Now here, I will assign this T plus 1, T minus 1, And then this is T sub x minus 1, T sub x plus 1. And so I measure the delta T along the x direction, and the delta T's in the y direction. Okay? So I have a time delay here between this, this, and this, and a time delay between this, this, and this. So from at this point, I get a vector. Actually, I get one for y, one for x. They're not necessarily the same magnitude. And then I get a resultant. This is resultant is a local velocity at that point. I'm not looking at activation time points. I'm getting this from the local action potential. Action potential I measure here, 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 here. And then, of course, to get a little bit more precision, we add these as well on the corners. And then this distance, right, is this distance times square root of 2.
So it looks like, it seems to me to be nearly the same thing, but like instead of getting the activation time...
It's different from activation time.
I see that, but instead of doing activation and then getting the gradient of that, and it seems like you're finding the gradient of a single point on the activation manifold. It seems like two methods are doing the same.
No, they're not doing the same thing.
Okay.
No. Because you are essentially taking a broad range of action potentials, measuring their peaks, and then getting a contour. The contour is an approximation of the true wave. That's the difference. Here, this is independent of whatever is happening throughout the rest of the heart. I'm giving you the velocity right there.
A terminological difference.
What
I'm trying to mean by activation time is precisely what you mean by it. You just call it different
some
name.
No, if you have...
When the thing happens.
Okay, here's a heart. I stimulate here, and I get a wave. And I have, this is 2, 4, 6, 10 milliseconds.
Yeah, those are isochrones, yes.
These are isochrones. These are activation times.
Oh, that's based on key.
How fast do you run the camera, Guy?
1,000 frames a second. You saw the signals, can show them to you again.
And each pixel corresponds to...
These time points are very precise.
Do you ever get zero time between?
Sorry?
What happens if T1 and T0 are the same time?
Oh, then I beg for mercy.
The wave is propagating.
No, you...
Like a big what? A plane wave going...
No, we have an algorithm that to correct that. Yes. It's in one of the earlier papers. Yes, we are aware of that.
So one
we're not gonna have an infinity conduction velocity, don't worry.
1 point is roughly 100 microns, right?
Sorry?
1 point is roughly 100 microns.
Yeah.
300, you said?
It's it's 15.
It's 1.57 meters and 100 swipes, or
1.5, yeah, divided by 100, yeah. Right. Okay, can I? No? Okay, why is conduction velocity changing? So we take myocytes and we incubate them for 24 hours with relaxin, and then we measure the NAD15 current. And this is the current to voltage relationship before relaxin and after relaxin. So relaxin has increased the current, sodium current, and it has also increased the protein that you can see by immunohistochemistry. This is not unique to rats. This is human recombinant relaxin. These are stem cells, human stem cells from Axol company. We didn't make those ourselves. But they're cultured, and we are looking for CTNT and DAPI, so you can see some of their features. And we then incubate them with or without relaxin. And this one, I think, was taken after 48 hours. We didn't trust ourselves to have a big effect after 24 hours. Turns out 24 hours is statistically significant. At 48 hours, there's a further increase in current, but it's not statistically greater than just 24 hours. So we're not really sure if that is a necessary thing to go 48 instead of 24 hours. But this is the current to voltage relationship we got from these human stem cells, and this is a doubling of the current and protein. So the sodium current effect caused by relaxin was new, and nobody had really looked into that before. This is different from the fibrosis, which was extensively studied in a number of organs. So we also showed that in these atria, there is a large drop in fibrosis as a result of this therapy. And if you now look at the relative mRNA levels of TGF-beta is suppressed by relaxin, collagen 1 and collagen 3.
But if collagen is there, how does it disappear?
So MMPs are also changed. These are the metalloproteinases, which degrade the collagen. So there is a cycling of collagen, which is about 5% a day. This is the most you're going to be able to drop your collagen levels. So we needed the 14 days to have a substantial effect on fibrosis, on the drop in fibrosis.
They go down to MMP2 and MMP9, they go down.
Right.
It works against?
No, that works in the right direction.
Is it?
MMPs essentially polymerize the collagen.
So what happens with the tissue once you remove the collagen, once you remove
it's catabolized, it's broken down, and so you have more catabolism and synthesis.
But it's replaced with something. What's
I'll show you the tissue. All that interstitial space is changed.
And what about collagenases?
No, we don't add collagenase. That would be cheating.
No, but apparently the body also makes collagenases if you want to, let's say, if you have to kind of get...
No, that's not how you regulate collagen or fibrosis.
But if you have to get through, I don't know, I'm not kind of...
Okay, so there are TIMPs and MMPs, metalloproteinases, that control the fibers in the extracellular matrix. And they're natural
fibers.
Enzymes.
But as far as I understand, they make fibers, not so, dissolve fibers.
No, you have both. The relationship between the function of TIMPs and MMPs is a little tricky because sometimes they work in concert and sometimes against each other. And so the balance of what you see in the heart is still, okay, somewhat controversial, but these have been already measured by a number of other investigators in the heart. And so this is consistent with that. So collagen dropped, collagen 1 and 3. TGF-beta is a transcription factor that stimulates synthesis of collagen by fibroblasts. The myocytes don't make the collagen. It's fibroblasts that are embedded in the wall of the atria and the ventricles. TGF-beta is elevated with age, and I'll show you some more on that, and it's reversed by relaxin. So that implies that the synthesis of the collagens are reduced, because one way to, if you have a fibroblast in culture, you add TGF-beta, they start to make collagen like crazy.
But do we have like arrow bars or something, N plus minus?
This is essentially the result of three RT-PCR measurements from...
This is molecular biology. This is what we work. 3 times is enough.
So another thing that is interesting is that smooth muscle actin went down by 30%. And smooth muscle actin is a marker of the conversion of fibroblasts to myofibroblasts. And myofibroblasts have a very different, they're very different cells. They start, according to one or two papers, that they start to make sodium channels, they make connexin, and they make a lot of collagen and a lot of fibrosis. They are the drivers of this fibrosis. So it's the transdifferentiation of fibroblast to myofibroblast that produces increase in smooth muscle actin, and this decrease by relaxin is essentially reversing this myofibroblast content. But one of the real reasons to show you this, which is the whole point, is that WNT3A dropped by 87 and WNT1A went up by 80%. And this started us on the road to explaining what is relaxin doing and how it's acting. These are transcription factors that are very well studied in developmental biology. And they guide the growth and differentiation of nearly all the organs in the embryo, and they change in their distribution and pattern of expression during embryonic development. Much less is known about them in adulthood. Supposedly, after birth, the human heart, and as well, most of the studies are not on human heart, that's difficult to do, but the heart at the neonate level is still not mature. Their sodium levels are reduced, they have little SR, the currents are still low. And wind signaling starts to retract. And as that happens, you change the expression of that myocyte. It becomes more extensively populated with sarcoplasmic reticulum, sodium channels, and so on. After birth, the cells are binucleated. Once they're binucleated, the myocytes aren't going to reproduce. So whatever myocytes you have is what you're going to continue to have. So the cells get bigger, but you don't get more cells. And once they're binucleated, they do not undergo cell division any further. So wind signaling, it appears to be central to this process of development. So we started to look and think, what is the relationship between changes in wind signaling and the sodium current? Because, so for example, if you get human stem cells and you apply the proper cocktails to turn them into myocytes, you have essentially myocytes that still don't produce a sodium current. And to push the maturation phase, you remove WNTs. So the cocktails contain WNTs to promote the proliferation, and then you remove the WNTs to promote maturation. So this is in cells that aren't undifferentiated. But here we're dealing with a situation where much less is known, where the cells are already mature. And yet, what is the role of WNTs with aging is really a black box at this point. And so there's a lot of questions to ask at this level. But in this, can we turn off the light so you can see this better? Does that help?
Yep.
So this is an aged atrium and an atrium that has been treated with relaxin. You see beta-catenin, a little bit here, at intercalated disc is quite weak. Connexins are very sparse. And then when you merge them, you see that there's an overlay between connexins and beta-catenin. After relaxin, and this is all taken under the same identical conditions, you can see a significant increase of beta-catenin. And beta-catenin is a protein which is stoichiometrically equal to the alpha-catenin at the intercalated disc. So you see them more at the intercalated disc, and you now see connexin 43, at higher levels and the merging of the two. So something happens to connexins and to their trafficking to the intercalated disc.
But control, is it age mice or?
Yeah, it's age. Normal mice will have more connexin than that.
Rats, yes, sorry.
There's no mice here, only rats, sorry. So this is the statistics at the expression of the changes in the expression. This is on the right atrium, and this is for a connexin 43 expression, and this is for the beta-catenin expression levels. So we are now trying to link this signaling pathway between relaxin and its receptor, cyclic EMPP Krebs, and this signaling pathway of Wnt signaling, increased beta-catenin to the intercalated disc, but beta-catenin also is known to go into the nucleus where it has a huge presence as a transcription factor. And it can change many, many features of many cells. And it's different in each cell. So somehow these two are talking to each other. And so what we have to do is try to figure out, does this pathway, how does this relate to this pathway? You can block this pathway with a peptide called Dickhoff protein. I don't know how it got its name, Mr. Dick. Yeah. Anyway, Dickhoff binds here at nanomolar concentration and prevents the interaction between the LRP56, which is a co-receptor with the frizzled receptors. These are the receptors for all the Wnts, and there are ten frizzled receptors. I have it here on the slide. And there's 15 different Wnts that have been studied. These are small peptides, and they all have different function, and they somehow signal. But the primary thing about how they signal is that they prevent beta-catenin phosphorylation, ubiquitination, and destruction of beta-catenin. So the effects of Wnt is to increase the levels of beta-catenin. And what we saw with relaxin is a dramatic increase in beta-catenin at the intercalated disc. And now, let me switch here to ventricular tissue of the same animals. The reason why we went to ventricular tissues, we ran out of atrial tissue. It is not very big. And so in the ventricles, you can do, again, you can measure conduction velocity. You can look at these changes in fibrosis and also in atrial cellular hypertrophy. So there's a small decrease in hypertrophy, which is the cross-sectional area of the cells, and there's also here a change in the fibrotic. This will appear a little bit better. This is an adult rat, an aged rat, and an aged rat treated with relaxin. Beta-catenin in an adult, you can see a great deal of beta-catenin at the intercalated disc, and a lot of the connexins are in the right position at the intercalated disc, with very few in the lateral position. But you do see some lateralized connexin 43. Lateralized connexin 43 is a mark of ischemic heart disease and heart failure. And that's been reported by a number of investigators way back, maybe 20 years ago. In the aged animal, you see much less beta-catenin, and you see a lot of lateralized connexins. Very little of the connexin seems to be located where it can do something between the cells at the intercalated disc. So this is, in fact, why conduction velocity is so diminished in these aged animals. There's a decrease in sodium current, there's a decrease in connexin, and there's a lateralization of connexin. And then there's fibrosis on top, which also has an impact on conduction velocity. Now, if you superimpose the beta-catenin and connexin 43, you can see, yes, there is some in the intercalated disc, like here and here. There is some, most of the connexins are lateralized. This is aged plus relaxin treatment. And now you can see a great deal more beta-catenin. And connexins are now expressed and shifted from the lateral membrane to the intercollegiate disc.
Do you have the connexin cohesin? The lateralization, is a part of the fibrosis process? Do you know?
Is it part of the fibrosis? I don't know if they're interlinked. If one causes the other, I have not heard.
Your control connexin 23 looks kind of unusual.
Yeah.
You've got very little contrast. Usually, connexin 43, you see this very bright stripes. Nothing here, but have red all over the place.
No, there's so clear bands here.
Well, there are bands, but the contrast is
very dependent on the method of visualization.
Well, it shows that the antibody could be not that specific or something happened. I don't know, because the pictures I used to see for connexin, for control, they show
so you can,
similar.
One of the things you can do.
So very low kind of.
Are you red green blind?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay, good. So one of the things that you have to watch out when you do a histochemistry with connexins. If you can put more antibody and increase the contrast and increase the brightness, but then you may not be able to see the difference when this is increased or decreased. So you tend not to add all of the antibody to get the brightest picture, particularly if you're going to do a comparison among different conditions.
It's just to do the opposite. You have to reduce the concentration to get the contrast, not the other way.
No, not the concentration. No, it's these could be brighter. Where you see the bands, they could be brighter. Yes.
But unless the localization structure, you see that the age with treated is much more similar to the control band than to the age of.
Yeah.
Really, we are more elongated and a little bit thicker.
Yeah. It's doing something. It's changing the characteristics and the morphology of the cell, which becomes a lot tighter.
How lower of the age control conduction was this? They weren't too bad.
9 months old.
No, I mean the actual CDs for aged controls in your study.
Right.
Didn't appear that low to me.
The age without relaxin?
Yeah.
They were quite low.
Well, the difference is very dramatic, but what were they? Like 80 centimeters?
No, well, it was a little bit lower than that, but what was more remarkable is that if you pace faster, they go down to 0.2.
They dropped all the way. The ventricular
losses? Yes. Oh, the ventricular is not as bad as the atria. But they did go down. Let me see. You want the exact number? Yeah, it was less so here it is.
It's impressive that there are quite high conduction losses, it seems.
And no gap junctions, no destructions.
So here, they do go down, but not as much as the. This is the restitution, and this is the conduction velocity as a function of rate. And in these animals, they are supposed to fast for us.
This is very high conduction velocity.
On an animal that goes at 400 beats a minute, you gotta have that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah? What about the action potential duration? Changing?
Oh, we published the details in the 2013 paper, and these were not, so they go down a little bit, but they are already so short in these animals. We saw the significance primarily at the slowest rates that you could. You can then say, yeah, here it has a significant. Once you start going faster, the shorter APDs were tenuous. You wouldn't say that it's statistically significant. It was a tendency, but not statistically significant. Okay. So here we looked at relaxant controls, and we stained for Wnt1 in the age ventricles. And this is the control, and connexin 43, beta-catenin, Wnt1. And after relaxant, there's a large increase in Wnt1 expression level. This is consistent with the RT-PCR for the message that I showed you earlier in that table. So these effects on Wnt1 to us suggest that you have major genomic modifications that are going to take place as a result of this transcription factor. Consistent with that is the effects on Wnt3a, where Wnt3a is suppressed by relaxin rather than increased. Again, consistent with the RT-PCR data. The effect of Wnt signaling is to protect beta-catenin from degradation. And as we see, there's more beta-catenin in the intercalated disc. But we also looked at beta-catenin diffusion and action in the nucleus. So nuclear beta-catenin here, this is the control, and after relaxin treatment. So we have DAPI for nuclear stain, and which is blue, and here is beta-catenin and the superposition. So the beta-catenin is elevated now in the nuclear space, implicating significant action as a transcription factor. This is the statistics, control, 10 nanomolar relaxin for 24 hours. This is nuclear beta-catenin, and 10 nanomolar, 48 hours, 100 nanomolar, still has a slight increase, and 100 nanomolar for 48 hours. And this is the percent of the nuclei that contain beta-catenin. So we start back at this scheme where relaxin can elevate cyclic AMP, pKa, and pKreb. And as a result of that, we know Wnt1 and Wnt3a changes, but we don't know if relaxin directly affects AKT, and AKT then inhibits GSK3 beta, and GSK3 beta is essentially the engine that breaks down beta-catenin. But you can have now an effect that's directly from the relaxin signaling to GSK3 beta by this pathway, or you can surmise that what pKreb is doing is increasing the Wnts. And Wnt elevation is then signaling through the Frizzl protein to inhibit GSK3 beta. So is this acting through the synthesis of Wnt1, or can it act directly? And another issue is, how do you test that? One way is to inhibit all Wnt signaling with DKK. Because if you add DKK and you block this, then you would block the effects of Wnt without necessarily blocking the indirect, the more direct pathway that doesn't go through Wnt. So we tested the effects of DKK. And what we do here is we isolate myocytes, and we put them in different concentrations of relaxin. And these are essentially three different dishes. And we measure NAV1.5 fluorescence. The NAV1.5 fluorescence is telling you what one of the assays of what relaxin does, which is one of the most reliable one. And you see an increase as a function of relaxin concentration. And the EC50 is about 1.3 nanomolar. We use the same approach to look at NAV1.5 in the cell without relaxin, with relaxin, and if we add DKK, we block the effect of relaxin. So the implication here is that the mode of action of relaxin is through synthesis of Wnt, and then Wnt has its own signaling pathway through beta-catenin to upregulate the sodium current. And if you add DKK plus relaxin, DKK blocks the effects of relaxin.
Have you tried similar thing with GSK 3 beta inhibitor like
we had substance. Sure, yes. Yes.
So does it mimic the effect of relaxin?
Yes. And I think this is here. Here it is, sure. It does what relaxin does. So here we're plotting NAD15 fluorescence and under different treatments. You can also add WIN1 directly to increase the sodium current. CHUR and relaxin are about the same, and essentially supporting your the very question you asked. We also tested here two two activators of adenyl cyclase. Two inhibitors of adenyl cyclase, NKY80 and SQ22536. And they essentially did not change very much the effect of that plus relaxin, plus or minus relaxin, which implicates that the cyclic EMP pathway is not the dominant pathway of how the relaxin mechanisms is acting. So here we shift a little bit, and I show you examples of fibroblasts grown in culture, and these are the controls. And the controls here, you can see this collagen around, and if you add relaxin, you suppress collagen synthesis. And this is relaxin plus TGF-beta. This one is better. Control, relaxin, and WNT1. Now the one I want to this is the one I want to show you. Control, TGF-beta. TGF-beta activates collagen synthesis, and that's a pretty dramatic increase. It's a transcription factor that promotes the transdifferentiation of fibroblasts to myofibroblasts. So collagen and DAPI are being recorded here, being the center of the cell. If you now have relaxin, you suppress, this is control versus this, not so much. But if you now have TGF-beta plus relaxin, you have suppressed collagen synthesis. This is much better than the previous slide that I showed you in terms of making that point. Now, if you add decog protein and TGF-beta, you have suppressed the effects of TGF-beta. So the effect is linked to WNT signaling. And so DKK plus relaxin suppresses the collagen synthesis, and of course here. So DKK is an important pathway for this fibrotic effect. This is the statistics, control, TGF-beta, collagen 1 expression. Relaxin suppresses it, and then if you add relaxin plus TGF-beta, relaxin suppresses this effect. Sorry? Want to stop?
No.
Sorry. You're right. So we were trying to understand the in broader terms what relaxin was doing, because once you start altering the genomics of cells, we only focused on the one we are most comfortable measuring, which is the sodium current, where we have a functional assay for by voltage clamping or by antibody detection. But if you want to start looking at all the breadth of actions that can occur with relaxin, we had to resort to a more, shall we say, faster, higher throughput approach. So we took 9-month-old animals and aged animals, and we treated either the young or the old with relaxin. And then we isolated the tissue after 2 weeks and used the genomic research core to essentially sequence the RNA. So this is a whole RNA sequence. And we then analyzed that, comparing our isolation of the RNA from the ventricles here, comparing it to the whole rat transcriptome. So relaxin altered 2,549 out of 26,597 mRNAs, which is the whole rat transcriptome, which is a substantial amount. But these were changed by more than twofold, and 17 of these were altered by more than 30-fold. So it has certain broad effects, and typically when people look at a change of greater than twofold, it's worth pursuing. It doesn't mean that it's true. There's lots of possible reasons why it may not pan out that there are real genomic changes in terms of expression of these, but usually when you start going twofold, then it becomes worth investigating further. Then we use Ingenuity software, and it identified 23 signaling pathways that were altered significantly by relaxin. Ingenuity pathway looks at certain signaling pathways that are already in the software, that are part of the program, and compares all the components of that pathway to see if they all go up together or down together. It's a way to increase the rigor of the observation that a pathway is altered or not altered by looking at, are they all going together in the right direction? Because some of them go in the right direction and others are altered in the wrong direction, then you kind of have to reevaluate the significance of these alterations. So this is sort of how we looked at the table. In this particular table, I looked at the changes in proteomics that have been described in the clinical field for heart failure. So in heart failure, these transcripts and these proteins go up in patients with heart failure. This is NT-proBNP. This is the brain natriuretic protein, which is essentially elevated when you have a lot of pressure in the atrial wall. And so it's a measure of abnormal hemodynamics. And the more severe the heart failure, again, the more severe this value is. FGF23, which has multiple functions, here interleukin-6, interleukin receptors, TNF receptors. These are all that appear, IL-6 receptors. GDF15, we know rather little about all of its functions. It's a transcription factor that has many functions and is elevated. In fact, in the literature, GDF15 is related to mortality in the heart failure population. And troponin T's, and there's two isoforms here, 1 and 2. So we looked at these RNA changes. These are the full changes between 24 months and 9 months. So this essentially changes by only 1.43 when you age. And then we looked at 24 months with relaxin treatment. Then this reverses. But this has a very large p-value. And the FDR is sufficiently low to be indeed one of the things that relaxin does in the heart failure patients. So the others here, heart failure markers, did not change so much. But interleukin-6 has a very big impact. Relaxin drops it by more than fourfold with a very large significance and FDR value. And these, the PPL, are you, these are phosphorylation. I don't recall this. I have to look it up again. CCL3 is a cytokine that is also altered, and GDF15 is also reversed. So it appears that out of this list, and this is a comprehensive list of all the markers that you see in heart failure, relaxin has an impact on several of them in a big way. We ran these experiments on male and female animals. So here again, we have aging and aging with relaxin. This is for females, and this is for males. And there are things that are not the same between the males and the females, as it turns out. These are the ones that change mostly in the female. The interleukin receptor, GDF15, interleukin 1 receptor, and this is a cytokine, which is an inflammatory marker. The males are the next set of colors. And you can see that they don't necessarily overlap here, and those last set overlap. So there are sex differences in the changes that occur with aging. The female heart has a lot more changes in terms of pro-inflammatory signals. This is the rat. And relaxin suppresses both, all of these markers in the male and the female, but the impact is much greater in the female because inflammatory effects are greater in this in these animals. So one of the things that we were asked to check, this is the right, this is the atrial natriuretic factor. We found that relaxin appears to suppress ANF. This is a marker of ANF, and ANF is an atrial natriuretic factor that is elevated in heart failure. And it's also elevated in the aged animals. But let me see here. It's AANP, this is male, and this is female. This is what I'm forgetting. Okay. So in the male, this is the young, the aged with relaxin. Young, aged with relaxin. So this is the male, this is the female. Okay. So in the young animals, and if you're a female, there's very little AANP. With aging, it's higher. It's also a little bit higher here, but not significantly. And then after relaxing, you suppress ANP. So ANP is a marker of hemodynamic abnormalities that result with aging alone. And the reversal by relaxin is very intriguing. Thing that was very surprising and intriguing about this result is that ANP is typically a peptide that is soluble and flows away. The only way you're going to be able to detect it in the tissue sections, is that it's actually forming amyloids. And in the literature, the clinical literature, there's a lot of work studying amyloidosis as a function of age, which is actually normal. So with age, we all develop this kind of amyloidosis. And relaxin reversed it. And there's nothing else that we know of that can reverse amyloidosis. So the amyloidosis can be formed by other components. This is an ANP amyloidosis, which is in fact one of the more common ones. This is what RNA-seq does for you. It sends you off on a wild goose chase. We looked at inflammatory cytokines, inflammatory chemokines. These are the fold changes by relaxin. They all are dropped. So it's a huge anti-inflammatory agent. And the statistics here are really impressive, given just an N of 4 animals. The Ingenuity pathway analysis that I mentioned earlier identified three pathways, some we know of and some are a little bit mysterious. And again, it's something that is suggestive, something that you may want to pursue. It doesn't mean that this is actually happening. You have to do a lot more legwork, RT-PCR, and so on. Let me skip this for the sake of time. And then macrophage infiltration. So in males and females, macrophage infiltration is evidence of this inflammatory response that we found in the RNA-seq. And in order to verify it, we compared 9 months, 24 months, and then 24 months plus relaxin. I don't know if there's a marker for macrophages, which is essentially this F480, which is a marker of macrophage. And what we try to do is label the nuclei with DAPI, and the surrounding membrane is essentially tells you this is a macrophage infiltration. And as you see more and more of these in in the female heart, less so in the male, but if you treat them with relaxin, the macrophage infiltration is dramatically reduced. So these inflammatory data on the RNA-seq is confirmed by actually measuring the levels of macrophages in the ventricular milieu. And this is my last slide. Modes of action. Suppresses IL-6, inflammatory transcription factors, reverses fibrosis, and fibroblast to myofibroblast transition. We have a great deal of remodeling of the extracellular matrix and ion channel expression. We found changes in CAV 1.2 alpha, but it's small levels, 1.3-fold, and that in the mRNA. We found changes in HCN4 in the ventricles of the aged animals, which was reversed by relaxin. HCN4, to be in the ventricle, is not normal, and it's not in the young adults. So the electrical remodeling, we're just touching the surface of all the things that it does, not just NAV 1.5. And the lateralization of connexin 43, and there's perhaps some indirect data that may have an effect on angiogenesis. So it's a bear of a molecule. It's not just an antifibrotic. It is dramatic anti-inflammatory. And we don't know yet to what extent it affects kernels. In the rat, it's going to be hard to look at those kernels. The more interesting thing would be in an animal that expresses a lot of IKR and IKS to see what it does there. And there's a long to-do list.
So you're in love with relax.
Sorry?
You're in love with relax.
Well, Arkady, I suggest you should be too.
Any questions?
Can we consider it as a therapy for arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy?
Yeah.
Sort of as a countermeasure?
Right, because of the abnormalities in the intercalated disc is correct. It may depend on whether this mutation in PRV that Jeff Saffitz is studying, we send him some relaxin, but he didn't have any luck at improving NAV1.5 in the intercalated disc. But in part, the mutation damages the trafficking. So here, the aged animals have functional trafficking. And when functional trafficking is still there, then it works. And it didn't appear to work in Jeff Sackett's hands. We're still talking about trying a few other things, but it didn't work the first shot.
What about for spinal injuries? Has anybody tried it?
Okay, so the field in neuroscience is just beginning. It has an impact on the extracellular matrix in the brain. And so you can imagine that things like Alzheimer's may be seriously impacted by relaxin 3. It's a different isoform than what we're talking about here. there are some so-so papers on cognition and relaxin and improved cognition. They're not convincing that. It wasn't done well.
Can you imagine also when someone gets a spinal injury, gets very one of the main points is inflammation.
Yeah.
So they try to treat them with that.
No, they haven't. No, there isn't any on that yet. Relaxin 2 is usually not.
Is it recommended by FDA for anything?
Sorry?
Is this drug recommended by FDA for any condition?
Not now.
But they already did clinical trial in that.
So the third trial didn't show any beneficial effect compared to standard of care.
And so
and the heart has dropped it.
So.
Yeah. And there's a couple of other groups that are trying to revive it for reasons that the Novartis protocol is really poor and not necessarily representative of something that for the fibrosis, you can't reverse fibrosis in 2 days. It's not going to happen. We need 2 weeks to see that part. You can change certain things in 2 days, like the sodium plant and maybe reduce the collagen synthesis. But you have to break down the old fibrosis in order to have a real impact. Although the effect is immediate, you have to do reversal. There's a lot of cellular hypertrophy, and we see dramatic effects in cellular hypertrophy in a 2 week treatment. And the 2 day treatment might not do it.
What was your results with this age grids? Were you able to persuade some clinicians to start?
I can't
some
even persuade more age.
Small clinical trial to try it in some patients.
Are there any side effects? Would you take it
because
yourself?
Because they're past phase one.
It's a natural hormone, so it's safe. What do you mean? You think it's not a chemical, it's a synthetic chemical. It's in a natural peptide and our body makes it. There is some evidence, for example, that it may worsen some cancers because the increase of Wnt signaling may increase proliferation. But if you don't have cancer, there's no evidence. There's really, this is only suggestive, it's not demonstrated at this point. Data, so if you have pulmonary arterial hypertension, we have some data that show that it reverses fibrosis in the lungs, improves compliance, and protects the heart from redox injury and arrhythmias in pulmonary arterial hypertension. But here, again, I don't see any movement for a therapy, even though it should be. The synthesis is recombinant, much like insulin now, so it's easy to make by this method. And the price should go down as it's used more and more. But like insulin, it took a while to figure out how to best treat diabetics with insulin. And there are implantable insulin pumps, and that's how relaxin should be delivered. You can't. I think there is no patch. There is a patch technology that they could develop, which has very fine needle points on the patch, and you could deliver relaxin that way. It hasn't been developed. You need special dispensation to make a mini pump for people to use.
But why do you think we need to use it on a permanent basis? Because if it removes the fibrosis, then maybe you don't need anything, so you just
time
treatment.
Nearly all the hormones in our body are delivered in a pulsatile manner. I don't know of any that you can just deliver in a continuous basis, which is what we're doing. So it's wrong. And we don't know the cycle. What is the oscillatory delivery of relaxin that we should be paying attention to? And if men with prostate cancer have a small elevation of relaxin, and you can now measure it in the bloodstream where it was before. And it's in the nanogram region. And people with pulmonary hypertension and cancer, but that's it. These are the only times you measure it in men. Now, a colleague of mine, Dennis McNamara, studied cardiomyopathies in women postpartum. So a lot of women have a form of heart failure postpartum, and it usually goes away. It's a reversible process, and it's not permanent. And some women, it gets severe, and if after multiple pregnancies, it doesn't reverse. So he made a plot of severity of cardiomyopathy as a function of relaxin in the bloodstream that was taken during the pregnancy. And there was a direct and indirect relationship that that's really quite pronounced. So it's cardioprotective in this case. Women who've had no pregnancies, meaning at least a pregnancy that lasted 6 months, according to this study from Duke, had fewer atrial fibrillation, had less atrial fibrillation if they've had 1, 2, and 3 pregnancies. So their risk for atrial fibrillation drops. It becomes minuscule. But if they've had more than 3, then it goes back up. And that's, you know, a sign that you're really having a pregnancy is very stressful to the heart. This is not something that should be minimized or ignored.
Do you do any controls? There are lots of anti-inflammatory drugs. Do you ever do experiments with other anti-inflammatory drugs as a control and see how that would compare with this?
What's a good anti-inflammatory drug? Aleve or aspirin? No, we haven't done that.
Is there any clinical evidence that people who take anti-inflammatory drugs chronically have lower incidence of atrial fibrillation?
No, all studies are negative.
What?
All studies are negative. So far.
So people have looked at that.
Yeah, but the poor cardiovascular, I mean, all the basic science studies show there's some positive effect of an antioxidant and anti-inflammatory stuff, and but it's been all negative.
Was it effective as anti-inflammatory?
I mean, anti-inflammatory, for example, aspirin. Right.
For a short time, though, not for a long, protracted time. I think that's the problem. That's the limitation of the
So this is for short time, not for long time?
According to the trial, it's probably a couple of years. But yeah, clinically, there's no benefit.
But you wouldn't recommend even baby aspirin that we take every day?
Well, that is for anti-platelet. That's not for anti-inflammatory.
That's anti-coagulant.
Well, no, we're talking about the acute coronary syndrome prevention, yes.
There is one thing that is worth mentioning. Novartis, after these first two successful trials, looked at the cause of death. How did relaxin protect patients survive longer? What it did is really reduce strokes, number one, and then sudden cardiac death. Number two. So these are the two things that were attributed to relaxin. And when that happened, we argued that 40% of all the heart failure patients had diagnosed atrial fibrillation. And atrial fibrillation is the primary risk of strokes. So that it may well be that in that context of what they did, they were protecting patients from AF and strokes, stroke-induced AF. And that is partially true and worthy of exploring further because the atrium has 8 times more receptors for relaxin than the ventricle.
You can do a retrospective study with that, just to go on.
Oh, we wrote a letter to the editor on this issue, and
They didn't like it much. Our suggestion. It was not in their wheelhouse, I should say. They wanted to cure a heart failure, not
Novartis, you should talk to Novartis. They spend.
That's what I'm talking about, Novartis, yeah.
Why wouldn't they? They want to. They already spend money on that company, so they want.
They stopped all operations on Relaxin now, just in case, if you want to know. they shut it down completely. We have data on aged bladder, which become very stiff and non-compliant. And after relaxing, they become compliant. And the force of contractions in the bladder almost doubles. There's an increase in calcium channels in the bladder.
Maybe they know something that they don't want to tell everyone?
Obviously they didn't tell me. So there's a lot of other organ studies that are worthy of pursuit. Cirrhosis of the liver. See, when we had these aged animals, we took the heart out, but we took all the other organs too and started to study them. The heart part was done. It was just a matter of trying to make some functional measurements in other organs. And in some of them, the follow-through was really impressive, and maybe more so than the heart.
Yeah, but let's say in your situation, I would focus on one effect and try to prove it. You keep nailing in the same spot, and then maybe you convince someone.
Right.
Well, okay, then it looks too good to be true. And it's going to cure everything.
So the NIH has not funded a grant on relaxing in over 25 years.
Very many patents that prohibit research.
No, it's just the people for the study section. Preferences of the study section, they are not interested. There's particular people who.
If you try to describe a change in wind signaling in adult hearts, they reject you with insults. They think wind signaling is important in embryonic development, and they don't want to think in terms of other things. But there's clear evidence now that with aging, there's functional and structural changes in the heart. Ed LaCala is a big proponent and has written detailed papers and review articles on the topic. And there's just a trickle that argue that wind signaling with aging is responsible for some of these changes that occur. That it's not, because you're reverting to an embryonic phenotype. So you start out with alpha myosin heavy chain in embryos, you mature into beta, and with age you go back to alpha. You start to get 20, 30, 40% of your myosin heavy chain changes to the alpha isoform. So that changes the kinetics of the contraction and the calcium affinity, which may have a huge impact on everything else that happens in the heart. So this change in genomics, fibrosis is a change in genomics, ion channel expression is changing, all of these changes are guided by a central regulator or controller, and we don't know what it is. And relaxin seems to hit on many aspects, not just one or two. But AF is a multifactorial disease, and if you attack just one aspect of it, it's not going to be enough. And it's the combination of all of them that precipitates this disease. Because we all have more fibrosis with age, we all have changes in the cardiac function, but a lot don't have AF. Something else kicks it in, and we have AF.
Thank you.